I love how the Prophet Muhammad said, "Don't tell me how educated you are, tell me how much you've traveled." Hey, I'm Rick Steves, and I think it's true, even if it's just the vicarious adventures we've shared here on the radio.
Yeah, there are plenty of times I stop because I see something, but I most often stop because I hear something first.
Today, to mark 20 years of weekly travels together, let's look at what the years have taught us while getting to know the world. As author Paul Theroux puts it,
"You suddenly have arrived at the vanishing point, something you couldn't see ahead. You've arrived at that point, and you have a point of view. You have a perspective on it."
Actor Martin Sheen tells us how the sensory overload of India affected him.
"Finally, when I did surrender to where I was and what was going on, it had a profound effect on me, and particularly no place greater than India."
And I'll flash back on how I started out as a teenage traveler in the summer of 73. Celebrate with us for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Author Paul Theroux has been keeping busy with a new collection of short stories he's written set in Hawaii, New England, and Africa. He tells us about The Vanishing Point in just a bit. And actor Martin Sheen reveals how filming on location has shown him realities that changed his worldview. That's all in the hour ahead. Today, we're marking 20 years since the very first edition of our weekly radio program. To produce it, I brought in Tim Tatton, who had been working in public radio in Ohio, Alaska, and the California wine country. In a few months, we started releasing an hour a week of travel-themed conversations, talking with all kinds of authors, guides, artists, and astronauts, and even with listeners like you, about their adventures and where they'd like to travel next. 20 years and nearly 800 episodes later, you can now hear Travel with Rick Steves on more than 500 stations, ranging from the Arctic shores of Ukiah, Alaska, to the Gulf waters of Key West, and from Agonia, Guam, to the far reaches of the American Forces Radio Network. Let's take a few minutes to remember just a sampling of the people whose company we've enjoyed over the past two decades, starting with a bicycling enthusiast we chatted with on our very first episode back in 2005.
I always tell people, you know, if you want to live your life in fear, spend an hour or two in front of the television set and make sure you're, you know, read the newspaper from cover to cover every single day. And if you want to think this world's a pretty amazing place, go travel around it or get on a bicycle and do it.
Willie Weir's advice still sounds good to me. A few years later, best-selling humorist David Sedaris stopped by to tell us about how he was navigating the cultural differences of moving to France. The hour we spent with David became one of our most all-time listened-to podcasts of the show.
I went to French school when I moved to Paris because I didn't speak any French. And I said to the teacher one day, she was telling us how to introduce people. And I said, "Well, how would you introduce someone as your boyfriend or your girlfriend?" And she said, "You wouldn't." She said, "It's nobody's business who you're sleeping with." So sometimes I find that discretion maddening, and sometimes I like it. But it's hard for an American because, especially when I first moved there, because I'm used to America. In America, you can say to somebody, God, I love your shoes. How much do they cost? Really? And how much does your watch cost? How much money do you make a year? If your shoes cost that much and your watch cost that much, how much do you make? Oh, you're divorced. How much do you have to pay in alimony? And I love that. And you cannot get away with that.
So that would be New York banter at a party, but you just couldn't do it in Paris, huh?
No, not at all. And in New York, you begin by saying, how much rent do you pay or how much
cost,
did you pay for your apartment? And you just can't do it there.
Oftentimes, I find that my travels show me how much more alike we are than we realize, even across different languages and cultures. Maeve Higgins has been getting to know refugees and immigrants settling in New York City, and she's compared their experiences to her own coming from Ireland. She also told us how surprised she was to discover how similar some things could be in Iraq compared to back home in County Cork.
What happens when you travel, too, if you're lucky mm-hmm. enough to get out to travel. Like, I went to Iraq to do a comedy workshop in Erbil, which, you know, is in Kurdistan up in the north. And something that I was completely taken aback by was, like, everyone offers you tea all the time. And I was just like, oh, this is exactly like Ireland. Everyone in Ireland is obsessed with tea. If you say no, they just think you're being polite. So they just keep saying, mm-hmm. like, have a cup. No, it's no bother at all. I put the kettle on now. And you're like, okay, in the end, you just take the tea. And it was the exact same in Kurdistan. Just like, you will drink this tea. And it was just reminded me of my mom.
Another Irish guest who brought us a real eye-opening conversation was Lord John Alderdice. He's had a position in Britain's House of Lords as a Liberal Democrat from Northern Ireland since 1996, after representing Belfast East for many years in the government of Northern Ireland. Lord Alderdice explained for us how he participated in negotiating the Good Friday Agreement, the agreement that finally ended the troubles in Northern Ireland back in 1998. It redesigned how the government would work there after recognizing the disturbed historic relationships between its people. I think you'll find that what he had to tell us in 2008 is just as important for us today.
If you analyze things in terms of political positions or moralistic terms, then you will get people divided. Let's talk about people as people. And that's a very different way of viewing it. Security measures on their own will never solve the problem. These are problems of relationships. They are political problems. And the only way they're going to be resolved in the end is by people sitting down and talking with each other. Mm-hmm. And think about those not as some alien group, but as human beings, as people with the same feelings and fears and thoughts and ambitions as you. Politics is not about how we agree with each other. Politics is about how we disagree without killing each other.
That's Lord John Alderdice, as we look back on just a few of our most memorable guest interviews over 20 years of travel with Rick Steves. Another favorite guest of ours has been writer and conservationist Terry Tempest Williams. She told us how learning to make mosaics in Italy helped her to find beauty in a broken world. And after traveling to Rwanda in the wake of their devastating civil war, she found encouraging life lessons in the rubble.
And it's not to romanticize poverty, certainly, mm-hmm. or war, but I think it's perspective. And what I realized in Rwanda with the horrors that took place there, what I realized is that on one hand, angels, on the other hand, demons, good, evil, how do we bring our hands together in prayer? And that if a human being is capable of this kind of atrocity, then I too am capable of that. And if a human being is capable of this kind of forgiveness, then I too am capable of that. And I think it brought me into a much deeper sense of my own humanity. And perhaps that's the gift of travel.
Terry's poetic writing about her beloved Utah desert home and the struggle to preserve lands considered sacred by its native communities have made her a public lands activist. For years, she's been calling on us to preserve America's open spaces and national parks from being exploited to enrich the few. But she told us that didn't come easily.
You know, I was raised not to speak out, not to rock the boat, make waves. And suddenly, because of the land that I love and the threat that it is under, this beautiful Red Rock wilderness, I have spoken out with many, many others. Hmm. And I think there are some people that wish that I hadn't or wouldn't. And I just think if we care about the land, if we care about the open space of democracy, if we care about citizenship, then we do speak out.
In 2016, I was surprised to learn how much Gloria Steinem had traveled. In talking with her, we learned how her time in India had an impact on how she approached her civic activism as a leading feminist rights organizer here in the United States. She reminded us how important it was to travel and to get to know the U.S. as well. A chance encounter she had in South Dakota helped her to see past appearances and presumptions when she was in town for a Native American conference, at the same time as the rough-and-tumble Sturgis motorcycle rally was going on nearby.
So I couldn't figure out why there were all these folks in black leather and tattoos and chains and nose rings and so on the plane. But once we got there, we discovered that, you know, this was this huge, huge global motorcycle rally, which I have to say, even though we were strong, daring women, we thought, kind of worried us because we'd seen movies. We understood or thought we understood that motorcyclists were maybe a source of danger. So when on the last morning I went into the dining room of my motel trying to be calm and open-minded in a room full of leather and chains and tattoos, I was totally surprised when a woman, an older biker chick, came over to me and said, you know, I really enjoy Ms. Magazine, she said. I just sort of couldn't believe I was hearing this. And that she said her husband also read it sometimes now that he was retired. And it turned out she had recognized Alice Walker, who I was traveling with, which also I never would have imagined. But she looked out the window and pointed me towards a purple Harley very proudly, because late in her married life, she had finally been able to travel on her own motorcycle as opposed to on the back of her husband's motorcycle. And that was her purple Harley. She said, oh, you should see my grandkids when Grandma rides up on her purple Harley. It made me, after she left, I thought, you know, we all have inside of us a purple Harley, a kind of freedom.
Yeah.
And we have only to find it and ride.
During the height of the COVID pandemic, when most of us were locked down at home for a while back in 2020, we checked in on friends to hear how their communities were coping and what it was like to not be able to travel. As a prolific traveler, Pico Iyer explained from his home in small-town Japan that the pandemic offered him a similar silver lining as I found where I live. Taking short walks in his neighborhood gave him a chance to finally look at his surroundings more closely and to think of it as home.
When my wife and I were stuck in our apartment in Japan for many weeks, we started taking long walks in every direction, which we've never done, though we've lived in that apartment for 27 and a half years. And we found just 5 minutes down the road, beautiful bamboo forest with flowering cherry trees all over and nightingales teaching their young to sing, just 3 blocks from our apartment. And we hadn't found it in more than a quarter of a century. And just as you say, I've always felt that the beauty of travel has less to do with the destination than with the fresh and open eyes we bring to it, and that indeed in our own neighborhoods there are wonders that would be amazing to people coming from elsewhere. And it's just a matter of reminding ourselves of that. And so I've been grateful to this moment for opening my eyes to what is really always around us.
Many of our guests over the past 20 years have told us about some incredible travel adventures. From the Johnson Space Center in Houston, astronaut Katie Coleman explained how 6 months of living and working on the International Space Station literally gave her a new perspective on Earth, our island home.
It gives me a lot of faith in people themselves. I know that after being up there and looking down at the Earth, it's not that I'm not patriotic, but I felt a little sort of, you know, just to think that I should put an American flag on my shoulder or think of myself as from one place, it just felt so limited when we're really all from the same place.
Oh, baby. Obviously, this is just a small fraction of the conversations we've enjoyed bringing to you in 20 years of travel with Rick Steves. What a gift it's been to learn from so many fascinating and different people. Coming up, we'll revisit a conversation I enjoyed with actor Martin Sheen. That's right after we find out what's new with author Paul Theroux. Don't forget, you can explore hundreds of hours of more great topics and guest interviews by digging around in our show archives. It's at ricksteves.com/radio. What's been your favorite moment from the show? We're always glad to hear from you by emailing us at radio@ricksteves.com. How do you assemble a lifetime of memories from traveling the world? Well, when you're a writer as celebrated as Paul Theroux, you just keep on writing. We figured we'd celebrate the 20th anniversary of our radio show by inviting Paul on the show as he celebrates his 84th birthday, as he's just published a new collection of short stories under the title The Vanishing Point. Paul joins us from his home on the north shore of Oahu to look at how his travels and adventures over the decades have introduced him to characters and situations that can remind us how an imagination and the written word can shine a powerful light on our lives. Paul, welcome back to Travel with Rick Steves.
Aloha from Hawaii, Rick.
Aloha, and congratulations on your latest book. This collection of stories, it's called The Vanishing Point, and it coincides, basically, with your 84th birthday. So, happy birthday, and when I think that you're 84 years old now, I'm looking at my next 15 years until I get to be 84. Now, like you, I've found my niche. I love what I do. But I don't know what's ahead. You've been there. What should I look forward to as a writer in the next 15 years?
Well, first, keep doing what you're doing, because there's no point in stopping it if you're good at it or if you like doing it. If it gives you pleasure, it gives you enjoyment, other people enjoyment, don't stop. don't stop. Don't take up golf, you know, or pickleball. Just keep reading, traveling, writing, and doing what you're doing, and you'll be happy. You'll be as happy as you are now.
You know, I've thought about this term pastimes. A lot of people, when they get older, they have pastimes. And, you know, when you get older, we realize we only have so many years left that we can at least be functional at what we enjoy doing. And in a case like you or me, we have all the money we need. I imagine there are things you'd still like to experience and do that have nothing to do with writing another book, yet you keep on working. There's a cost to that. You don't get to do those other activities that might be lurking in the back of your creative spirit, but you write, and that takes a lot of your bandwidth. Why is that?
But that's not entirely true. Here's the point. I work in the morning at home, and in the afternoon, I always go to the beach. I have a folding chair, and I take my work with me. I sit at the beach uninterrupted, and I write on my clipboard 200 or 300 words, a page or two, and then I go swimming. I have an outrigger canoe. There's three Hawaiian guys that I go paddling with. So my writing life is bound up with sunshine, swimming, and paddling a canoe.
So that's you've got yourself a routine that sustains you. It sounds like a lot like Picasso's work schedule. And
does it?
He would work famously in the morning really hard, and then he'd put it down and he'd have the afternoon and the evening to socialize and do other, you know, fun things that stoked his spirit.
I don't socialize much. I'm not antisocial, but I don't know any writers here, and I don't know many readers either. So, and as far as the age goes, I mean, you mentioned my age, which is a very daunting figure, but think about Bob Dylan still strumming his guitar.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Mick Jagger is coming up. He's 80-something, and he's still rock and rolling. Martha Stewart's my age, you know. And so it's not a question of age. It's you've got to keep moving, stay positive, keep working, and you get better at it. You know, I mean, there's something called the older style. I mean, your style of travel changes. Your style of writing changes. You mentioned Picasso. Picasso was doing completely different work in his old age from what he did as a youth. And I think that that's a discovery that you make as you age, which is you look at things differently. People look at you differently. The world is different. There's not a lot of new things in the world. People tell you, hey, guess what? And you say, and they tell you something. So, well, I remember that from 1968. You know, if you say that, you're a phony.
Right.
But actually, you see a kind of repetition in the world, repetition of dictatorships, repetition of stupidity, repetition of innovation, and all of that you've seen. I mean, not that there's nothing new under the sun, but you have a perspective that, you know, apropos of the vanishing point, you suddenly have arrived at the vanishing point. What something that you thought was a full stop, something you couldn't see ahead, you've arrived at that point, and you have a point of view, you have a perspective on it. You thought, I didn't realize I would get to where I am now. And that's a revelation and an enlightenment.
Paul Theroux's our guest from his home base on Oahu's North Shore right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Paul's been called a master of the short story and has written some 60 novels, short stories, and works of nonfiction. Global travels and identities tied to a sense of place play a key role in many of his works. His latest collection of stories is called The Vanishing Point. His website is paultheroux.com. Paul, your book is called The Vanishing Point, and you defined it a bit a moment ago, but let's talk about this because it is such a great title for this collection of short stories. It's about 300 pages. Each story is about 20 pages long, and you have this overarching concept of the vanishing point. In art, we kind of know what that means. What does that mean as you tie this collection of stories together?
What it means to me is extinction, the sense of mortality. At my age, I think of that a lot. I think of, there's a nice word we have in English called finitude, finality. So I feel my age at times, but also I wanted to depict it. I wanted to depict the lives of older people or the lives of people who see that their lives are diminishing. And the title story is, I have a guy in Maine. He works for a painter that doesn't do vanishing point. The painter does kind of color field painting. But he sees a calendar, a man standing by a railway track, and he sees the railway track the vanishing point of the track in the future, and he thinks, what's there? Is it a full stop? What's beyond the vanishing point? At the end of the story, I won't spoil it, no trigger warnings or anything like that, but I say that he discovers what's there. And the other stories, similarly. So as you get older, you begin to care about different things. You see different things. You have a vantage point that you lack when you're younger. And you have it as a traveler, too. When you go to a place, I think an older person has a different reaction to places than a younger person. And these are in the stories, too.
You know, Paul, you were a kid once. I was a kid once. Now, 40, 50, 60 years later, we're the old guys. And the kids today, they're going to be old guys and old gals someday soon. What's your advice from your vantage point to young people who are very headstrong about how the world is?
I remember being young. I remember very distinctly because I felt that I lived in a web of obscurity. I felt beneath notice. I thought, how do you ever manage to accomplish anything in this world? How do you become a worker? How do you graduate from college? How do you pay your taxes? The world was such a mystery to me. I was living outside Boston, Massachusetts. You know, one of my classmates who was similarly bewildered about what's going to happened to be Michael Bloomberg, who ended up with $85 billion. And anyway, we were in the Boy Scouts together, and I can say that we didn't have a clue.
Right.
And my advice, I don't have a lot of advice. My advice would be, listen, don't take anything for granted. And I was fortunate to grow up in a very large, slightly dysfunctional family. There were seven children. I had six siblings, which taught me the virtue of negotiating. So if there's a cookie on the plate, you never snatch it. You never, because you'll make a lot of enemies if you do. And you make sure that no one wants it, and then you take it. And that helps in travel. So growing up in a big family helped me when I traveled because it made me a listener. It made me a negotiator. And it made me take nothing for granted. And it's not that I fit in, but I was more patient and I was more a negotiator.
You know, your stories are just so empowered by the characters that you develop. And to me, your passion for having good characters in your writing is similar to my understanding that that's the essence of good travel. I always like to say meeting people is what sort of carbonates the experience. Talk about the importance of characters in your travels and in your writings. I mean, you love being on a train. What a great place to bump into characters, right?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I would say first, another piece of advice I might even give is leave home. I mean, you don't really know the world at all if you just stay at home. The writer who travels, the writer who leaves home, gets away, meets other people, tests themselves against other people, gets to know people, learns other cultures, learns another language. Not a great deal happened to me until I was 21, 22. Then I went to Africa. I joined the Peace Corps. My advice might be become a volunteer. Go somewhere. Be a teacher. Don't just travel to a place. Work in the place. So I wasn't sure what was going to happen to me until age 22. I was in the Peace Corps. I was in Malawi, Central Africa. It was actually called Nyasaland then. It was a British colony. And I realized this is a new world. It was completely unexpected. I learned the language.
Hmm.
I made friends. I wasn't earning much money, but for 2 years as a Peace Corps teacher, I discovered what it was that I wanted to do. I wanted to be a writer. I had thought I was going to be a doctor. And then I realized, no, suddenly I realized there's a big world. There's something to write about. And that was a very, very important moment for me. And it wouldn't have happened if I'd stayed home.
You know, I find that is so fundamental, what you're saying. And when I think back on my story, if I didn't go to places that were out of my comfort zone, if I didn't have the gumption to complicate my life by getting out of my norm, I would not have the dimension that I have to draw from in my writing. I remember when my dad took me to the airport when I was a kid to go down to the troubled action in Central America. Rather than saying, have a good trip, he said, don't be duped. He was afraid I was going to get out of my norms.
Yeah.
And now when people say have a safe trip, I almost think they're saying that. Don't be duped. You might see the world is more complicated than you thought it was.
When I told my father I was going to Africa, he said, that's great. I said, I'm going to be in Africa for 2 years. In the end, it was 6 years. And he said, that's great. And he said, write to me. I mean, what power? He didn't say, oh, it's dangerous. And it was dangerous. In 1963,
yeah.
There was coups, there were revolutions, the countries becoming independent. The Congo was a horror. He said, great, great.
Yeah. Paul Theroux has been called a dean of travel literature with his prolific output of stories, novels, and writings that explore the human psyche in settings all around the world. He's celebrating his 84th birthday with us right now on this, our 20th anniversary edition of Travel with Rick Steves. Paul's recently released a collection of stories called The Vanishing Point. It's the latest in the more than 60 works he's written with stories that take place in Hawaii, New England, and Africa. All locations Paul has lived in and gotten to know really well. You know, Paul, everybody in travel writing seems to throw around these great famous quotes from other famous writers and so on. Mark Twain, you know, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, narrow-minded, and so on. I've got two favorites. One is from Mohammed, and he said, don't tell me how educated you are, tell me how much you've traveled. And another one I like to throw around is from Thomas Jefferson. And to be honest, I don't even know how true it is, but I've got this sense that Thomas Jefferson said, travel makes a person wiser, if less happy. And those are very wise to me.
It makes you, well, experience does make you wiser. It also gives you information. So suddenly you have data, you have experience. Your brain is expanded by that, and you're not getting it from the internet. Let me quote Mao Zedong.
Okay.
He said, real knowledge arises from direct experience. The only real knowledge arises from direct experience. In other words, you learn by doing. You don't get it on the internet. You don't even necessarily get it from a book. You don't get it from someone that's telling you. You get it from direct experience.
Mm-hmm.
Suffering, travel, work. You can have any opinion you want about Mao Zedong, but direct experience was what I lacked. I was home, sitting on my sofa watching TV or reading a book. Suddenly, when I left the house, when I got out of the house, I had direct experience. And that's what travel offers you. Also, so in my book, The Vanishing Point, all of those stories arise from experience that I've had, either stories that people told me,
yeah,
or places that I've been. So they're set in a lot of different countries. The book wouldn't exist if I had stayed home, or it would exist maybe, but in a totally different, less interesting form.
So, Paul, we've been talking about leaving. You're quite comfortable, it seems now, with your world on the North Shore of Oahu. How is the people scene there to your liking? Because it's not an intellectual kind of crowd, is it?
No, you would come to Hawaii to discuss the lyricism of Henry James' Late Manner or Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, that we do have an opera here and so forth. But you might, you know, people live their lives here. They work, and they're constantly in contact with other people. So we have 10 million tourists a year here. So local people have to cope with the influx of 10 million tourists, and they need to negotiate that. I find Hawaiians here, the ones I paddle my canoe with, I love their company. They're working men, actually, and women. That's a lot more interesting than, I don't know, then maybe discussing Shakespeare to a certain extent. And they live lives that are totally unlike mine. Their worries are different from mine. They worry, you know, they have young families and so forth. They're all younger people, actually. And it's great to associate with younger people. I love being with them.
We tend, if we're not mindful of this, we tend to gravitate toward people who see things the way we do and think as we do. And it makes us... It takes the swizzle stick out of our drink, I think, and it's a problem.
That's true. But also, you know, there's another aspect. You live your life very similar to mine. Your passport is full of stamps and has a lot of pages. So is mine. So I'm not here 12 months of the year nonstop.
Right.
While living here, I've written numerous travel books. I wrote The Pillars of Hercules, Traveling the Mediterranean. I wrote Riding Iron Rooster about China.
Yeah.
I wrote my book Deep South, riding my car around Mississippi and Alabama. So I live in Hawaii, but I'm not here all the time. I was there when I lived in England. I was constantly traveling. You know, there's a great line in D.H. Lawrence's book, Sea in Sardinia. He says, comes over one the need to move. Comes over one the need to move.
This is Travel Trick Steve's. We're talking with Paul Theroux, and his book is The Vanishing Point. You know, Paul, as a traveler, it's curious to me, people are fascinated by which corners of the world are, quote, the most content. Have you seen these most content countries lists, and what's your take on that from your experience?
I don't think there are any content countries, but there are a lot of corners of countries or communities that are content, that really are content. And you
and
see
what do they
them,
have in common?
What they have is deep roots, usually, in a culture. Mm-hmm. They have deep roots. They have traditions that sustain them. They have humility. They usually have great respect for ancestors and for older people. Hmm. And it's usually reciprocated. So you find it content that way because they're whole cultures, they're complete. And that's where the contentment comes from, that they live in a space that's safe, that's thriving. They may not be wealthy, but wealth has nothing to do with money. Wealth is a state of mind of having enough, the economy of enough. They have enough. They don't want more.
Paul Theroux, thank you so much for sharing a lifetime of wisdom gained through travel, through meeting people, and through organizing those thoughts in your many books. Congratulations on your latest book, The Vanishing Point, and happy birthday.
Thank you, Rick.
You can listen to Paul Theroux's previous conversations with us from the web links we provide with this week's show. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, let's revisit a great conversation we had a couple years ago with Martin Sheen. He'll tell us how his travels have inspired his work as an actor and enlightened his activism for social justice causes. And we'll toast this 20th anniversary edition of Travel with Rick Steves, recalling how it all started right out of high school back in the summer of 73. When the work you do takes you to other countries, it can open you up to realities and ideas that you might have never considered or expected. For a major Hollywood actor like Martin Sheen, being on location can lead to events and opportunities that aren't included in your script. A couple years ago, Martin and his son Emilio Estevez came to the Rick Steves offices near Seattle to film an interview about travel with me. They included it at the end of their movie, The Way. We invited Martin into our own radio studio to tell us about how his travels have influenced his views and stirred up his political activism over the years. Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to see you in person and to have you here in our studio. And we've both been sort of inspired by our travels, haven't we?
Very much so. In fact, I had a profound turnaround in my life, and one of the most important events in my life that literally changed the direction of my life was in India in 1981 when I went to do a role in Gandhi.
Yeah.
And I'd been in third world countries, including Central America and the Philippines. But I had never encountered so much horrible, horrible poverty on such a huge level. And, you know, poverty has a look, of course. It has a dimension. It has a smell. Mm-hmm. It has an unbelievable power. It can draw you to itself or it can repulse you. And I was drawn and affected both ways. And luckily, Emilio was with me, as a matter of fact. And he used to dive into these crowds of children and beggars on the street and come home barefoot with a pair of shorts. He'd given everything away, literally. And he kept asking me, you know, when we'd have a day off or some free time, let's go out on the street. You got to see what's going on out there. You got to go. And finally, I started going out, and it was life-changing.
So that's interesting to me that even on a movie set where there's so much riding on the health and the safety of every player, you actually were out there in the streets on your free time, apparently, and you had a curiosity and an interest
in that. We had a great number of people who were called extras or background people. They were people who lived in these locations.
Okay, so you
participated in these huge crowds. We were literally in a crowd on the Rajpath in Delhi for the recreation of Gandhi's funeral with 1 million human beings. And all over Delhi for weeks before the filming of the scene, there were flyers everywhere, come dressed of the period in 1948 and join us to celebrate the father of our country, Mahatma Gandhi.
That was
81, right?
81, yeah. Mm-hmm.
3 years before that, I went to India for my first time. And really? It's the first time I was aware of the gap between rich and poor.
Yes.
I didn't even think about it in my privileged little protected upbringing here in Seattle.
Yeah.
And I remember going across, I was in Tehran, and I was sort of leaning up as a poor backpacker, really, against a bank building in Tehran. And I saw there was these beggars and there was these wealthy people, obviously. And then you get to India and you just see it in vivid color. But at the same time, India became my favorite country to travel to because there's a lot of love and a lot of humanity, especially amidst that poverty.
It's unbelievable. You see people who the only way to describe them is enviable joy.
Yes.
Because they're free.
You know, I always say, people ask me, why do you like India? It walloped my self-assuredness, my ethnocentricity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like to say it rearranged all my cultural furniture. I thought I knew what pain was. I thought I knew what love was. I thought I knew what music was. And I got there and it's, I'm not wrong, but I'm not exclusively right.
No. And you always know that you have a passport in your pocket.
Yeah.
And you can leave.
Yeah.
These people will never, for the large majority, ever be able to leave.
They'll never see their name on a plane ticket.
No.
And that's a very important thing for us round-trip revolutionaries.
It's unlikely you will ever see any one of those faces again in your life, that they're a gift for that time and place, and that's it.
Martin, you're famously kind of a troublemaker when it comes to demonstrating for peace and justice issues. And
I'd say infamously in some
infamously.
Circles.
Infamously. I can't believe it. I was studying this, and you've been arrested 68 times for speaking up on issues. Have you ever thought that had you never traveled, you probably wouldn't have such of a difficult time with the law?
No.
imagine a Martin Sheen that had never traveled.
Oh, no, I can't. No, he's dead and gone.
We wouldn't be talking to him now, right?
No, I didn't go to many of these places willfully. You know, it was a job, you know.
Yeah.
It's what I did for a living.
Yeah.
I couldn't determine the location or the country or the culture,
right.
You know. So luckily, I was taken in the places that finally, when I did surrender to where I was and what was going on, it had a profound effect on me, and particularly no place greater than India. India,
right.
I mean, it just changed every fiber in my being. I was almost 40. I was 40 years old, so it's half a lifetime ago. And since the awakening that happened, as you know, the expression I used, a friend of mine used to describe what changed him, I would subscribe to it too. I went into the third world, and they cracked open my heart.
Yes. It complicates your life when you travel, if you're a caring person.
Very much so, yeah. I went to Nicaragua when the Sandinistas had just succeeded and Somoza had been driven out. So it was a new democracy. It was very exciting. And I was invited to come and to participate in their new democracy and to take home what I had witnessed to the United States. And I wrote President Reagan and told him I was in country. I never heard from him. But they couldn't say at least that I didn't let them know I was going. And I got a letter when I got back. I was there for a couple of weeks, and I got a letter from John Poindexter, who was one of his national security advisors. And he said, well, we did receive your letter, but frankly, you are well-meaning but misinformed.
Yeah.
And so after what I discovered there, I would trust being well-meaning far more than being misinformed.
It was a real high point of our work to have actor Martin Sheen as our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. Martin was with me in 2023 while filming a special travel feature that accompanied the re-release of his movie, The Way. The movie takes place along the Camino de Santiago pilgrim route in Spain. Martin is reflecting with us on how he values what his travels have shown him about the world and how it can inspire us all to take a stand on behalf of others when we get home. Martin, as I mentioned earlier, you've been arrested 68 times, and I'm just curious if the number of arrests has been a measure of what causes are closest to your heart. If you think about your different times you've been demonstrating and then arrested, what are the top three or four or five causes that you've been out on the streets for?
The number one, and still is nuclearism.
Uh-huh.
We came up through the Cold War where we were on ready alert, you know, it seems that we never knew by accident or design the world would end with a nuclear confrontation.
And then after that?
Would be the environment. You know, they're all, well, nuclearism, of course, is connected to our militarism, You know, our nation spends at least 53% of our budget on our militarism. And
a lot of money to make us safer, supposedly,
yeah.
But other
and
things might be a better investment.
You know, you know Europe so very well, and you see infrastructure, travel arrangements, and security, you know, not just security, but health and education,
right.
How much more of their budgets goes to that because they don't have a huge army.
And counterintuitively, you can make a case that it makes them stronger.
Exactly.
And that's the interesting thing. I'm sort of into soft power instead of hard power.
Exactly.
So you have to say, yes, we want to be safe. We want to be secure. And Martin, what about domestic travels and workers' rights? What has your experience been on the road to be more tuned into that?
Yeah, we try never to stay at a hotel if we can help it that is not unionized, and sometimes we end up in youth hostels and other places along the way. But yeah, unionized labor. I was very influenced and inspired by Cesar Chavez, and I got to know him a bit toward the end of his life. In fact, he got me to quit smoking.
That probably let you get arrested a few more times with
a
longer
more times
life.
With Cesar, one of my heroes.
You know, your son Emilio wrote that he remembers as a youngster watching you on TV being hauled away in handcuffs and reciting the Lord's Prayer at the top of your lungs. And he said you almost looked possessed or like crazy. And it took Emilio years to understand the why of it. You know, what is the why of it?
To be present in the time that I live. And to have, if not an effect, at least an opinion. I don't think I've ever really changed any of policies, not towards homelessness, nuclearism, militarism, education, whatever I was protesting against or for. I don't really believe that I had any effect, or at least it wasn't up to me to determine if I had an effect.
Mm-hmm.
The only effect I'm absolutely certain I created was on myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I own those experiences for myself.
That's effect enough.
Yeah, just me. I'm the only one that has changed. Yeah. So I do it for myself.
You've lived a life where you've been impacted by your travels, and then you've been involved and engaged in the challenges of our world in a broad, in a global sense, as well as in a local sense. You know, Martin, I love the notion of transformational travel. That's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But it's a lot easier to say than to actually experience. With all of the travels you've done for your various sets on movies and so on, share with us a special moment far from home that was really transformational to Martin Sheen.
Well, it was in India. It was a unforgettable moment where Emilio and I were surrounded by a crowd and mostly children, and a police officer had to come and help us get through the crowd. Literally, it was in Bombay. And he got us to a taxi, and we got in the cab and began to move away from this community, this neighborhood. And I felt a presence a few blocks away from the community. I looked around, and there was a little girl hanging onto the taxi, and her face was inches from mine outside. And we said, please stop the car. And the driver stopped, and she couldn't speak English. I guess she spoke Hindi, you know,
but she wanted
some money. She was in tatters, and she had this most extraordinary mug. I call people's mug their mug shot, you know, the thing you're going to remember.
Yeah.
I never forgot her. And it was that sense of profound sense of envy in a way, because she was so joy-filled just to have made this journey, these few blocks hanging on the back of our cab. And we told the driver, okay, let's put her inside and we'll take her back. And we did, and we shared what little we had at that time. And, you know, every time I'm traveling somewhere in third world, I always look over my shoulder. Is there anyone hanging on the back? Now, mostly they'll hang on to your heart, you know. And that's what makes the difference. The people there that you know, as we mentioned before, you may never and you're unlikely to ever see them again. And if I did see that little girl again, that was 40 years ago.
But those memories, Martin, those memories are the most beautiful souvenir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you take them home, and then as we live our lives here and when we go into the privacy of the voting booth or however we make our decisions, if we remember the humanity of this planet, we can thank our travels for that.
Yeah, very much so.
Martin Sheen, thanks for joining us. And like they say when you're on the road, buen camino.
Keep on traveling.
Keep on traveling. You can hear more of our full-length interviews with Martin Sheen in our Travel with Rick Steves show archives. And there's actually a link so you can watch the interview with me, Martin, and Emilio that ended up in the movie. It's in the notes for this week's show. You'll find that at ricksteves.com/radio. Because I travel so much of the year, I find it comforting to come home to the town I was raised in. After all these years, I still live in Edmonds, Washington. It's the little town that launched me into a European traveler. Joining me now for a glance back at how our travel adventures turned into a career is my original travel buddy from high school, Gene Openshaw. He also joined me 5 years later on our epic On the Hippie Trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu backpacking trip, and Gene now co-authors the Rick Steves Art Appreciation books. Here's how it all started as a pair of teenagers vagabonding our way across Europe right out of high school in the summer of 73. Okay, let's go back. Let's go back to the year 1973. Richard Nixon was facing Watergate. The world was facing an oil crisis. And two teenage boys from the suburbs of Seattle were heading off to Europe on their first trip, the first time overseas, away from their parents, the first taste of high culture. And that was me and Gene Openshaw, our first trip to Europe on our own. I'm joined by Gene Openshaw now. He was my travel partner back in 73, and he's been working with me for the last 40 years. Boy, it makes me feel a little bit old, but we're still young at heart. And Gene's the co-author of several of my guidebooks. Gene, how did a couple of kids like us, with no cultural background, grow up to be talking about art and history now on the radio?
Well, let me take you back to our first trip. I brought something here. Hoping to kind of spark some memories
of
what
travel
was
like
back
then.
A few coins from the pre-Euro days. Here, look.
Okay, we're talking 73. So back then, we had a Deutschmark, we had a franc, a Greek drachma.
Here's a lira.
And a Norwegian, a Danish crown with a hole in it. I love it.
Europe back then was quite different than travel today. You just think about some of the most basic things that we take for granted, like phone calls. If you wanted to make a phone call, you had to gather a bunch of coins like this.
Pop them in. You'd get a whole, all the coins you could gather, pop them in, and you get to talk 1 minute to your girlfriend or your mom and dad.
Yeah. The world wasn't globalized. Very few people spoke English. And I really had the sense, I don't know about you, that we were kind of on our own out there, sort of dark side of the moon.
And it was the Cold War, and that was scary. I remember standing in Berlin next to that wall, and it was scary. Crossing borders, just remember, you know, angry dogs and strange people coming at 2 o'clock in the morning to take your passports.
And you did not question them.
No, no.
Yeah, Europe was kind of a battlefield, a battleground between these two nuclear superpowers.
But way back then, I still think there was the seeds of globalization. It was like we were on the edge of a new world.
You know, remember this? We're on the Rhine River. We're at that castle in, was it Bacharach? Where you're up on that hill.
Yeah.
Beautiful summer night. We're out there. We're a couple of teenagers, and we're surrounded by a bunch of other teenagers and their hormones. And I did get a sense of globalization because we all had some things in common. We all had gotten Eurail passes.
We all had $3 a night for a bunk at the youth hostel there.
Yeah. Yep.
We're all fascinated by medieval castles.
And fascinated by pop culture. That was about the only thing we had in common.
That's true.
You know, the Beatles. She loves you. Yeah, yeah,
right, yeah,
yeah. Ah, das ist gut.
Right.
You know? Or talking about Hollywood movies.
And Coca-Cola, everybody wanted a Coke.
That's where I thought we really connected with the Europe that was coming of age and would become the globalized world.
We learned a lot about culture, even though I remember just going to the museums because my mom said it would be a crime not to. But stepping into those museums, we did gain an appreciation of high culture.
Mona Lisa, that knocked my socks off.
Stepping into St. Mark's Square in Venice. Oh man. Stepping into the greatest cathedral in Europe, St. Peter's Basilica.
Oh, man. Yeah, the Baroque, the gold leaf, the statues.
You know, we didn't probe too deeply into it, but we did have a respect for what people did centuries ago.
And when we came back, we weren't art scholars by any means, nor are we now. But we do at least have a knowledge and understanding of what's out there. But, you know, we learned a lot from the museums and the art. But what really taught me the most, I think, was just the fact that Europe was so different then. It was kind of jarring when we went there. It kind of opened our eyes. You know, we're in Amsterdam, and you're seeing these hippies and freaks and smoking pot and the girls on Zeedijk Street and the sex trade. And for a couple of teenage boys, that was kind of a you're kind of trying to figure it all out.
We were like two little rhesus monkeys huddling together and hugging each other, trying not to get into too much trouble.
See no evil, hear no evil.
But when we flew home, yeah, the world was our playground.
Yeah.
I remember looking back on my journal from that trip, there were so many just mistakes that turned into great experiences. Two kids opening up to the rest of the world.
It was a bit of a rude awakening, but it was probably a healthy one for a couple of young kids from the suburbs.
I'm sure thankful for that trip. That was the best trip ever, Gene. And what's great in my mind is that those kind of wide-eyed Wonderland adventures that we had when we were 18 years old, so many decades ago, kids are having them today, too. It's still possible, and that's the magic of travel.
Go for it, guys.
Trucking, I'm going home. Whoa, whoa, baby, back where I belong. Back home, sit down and patch my bones and get back trucking. Come on, come on.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton,
Donna Bardsley,
and Casimiral Hall.
Website uploads are by Sherry Quirt and Andrew Wakeling.
Promotion support comes from Sheila Gerzoff, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank.
You'll find more at ricksteves.com/radio.